What was it really like to grow up with the British invasion, the second British invasion, through the progressive movement, and into the icons like Elton John and Bruce Springsteen, as music progressed from its infancy to where we are today? What was it like to experience a rock concert in the 70s that defined an entire generation? What was it like to build our first stereo system, to listen to this great new music, components that were designed to last a lifetime? I know, I still have mine. I still use it. We learned how to transfer our music from home to our cars, the advent of cassette tape and 8-track. I was there. I experienced it all. Through the decades, the music, yes, has changed. The technology, yes, has changed dramatically. How do we, as boomers, deal with the rapid change of technology when back in the day, things moved at a snail's pace and it was easier to adapt? I was there. I am there. I experienced it all. What was it like to experience Woodstock, Cal Jam, Us Festival, Live Aid? I was there. I've seen it all. Join me, Brad Blue, as I give my perspective.
As well as me, Alec, his son and the voice in the newer generations.
On all these wonderful events that we grew up with as boomers on Full Circle Analog.
For over 20 years, Spider-Man has led the headlines of major newspapers, either in new movies or new games or new appearances or a musical, apparently. The iconic character who is underneath the mask, the 16-year-old Peter Parker, has been a focal point of public culture since I was a little kid. I remember some of my earliest memories are of playing with a magnetic Spider-Man set where he'd automatically swing from one lamppost to the other using the magnets on his hands. After that, it was a Spider-Man video game for the GameCube called Ultimate Spider-Man, and not to mention the animated shows that were produced in the 2000s and earlier, and the first major movies directed by Sam Raimi, featuring Tobey Maguire as Spider-Man, the 16-year-old. Tobey Maguire doesn't always look it, but he does play the 16-year-old in that movie. And I wanted to talk about some of the enduring aspects of the character and the enduring legacy of superheroes in general. Because over time, though they are still largely spectacle and meant to be fun, enjoyable movies, there's a lot more depth to the superheroes than simply the superpowers, at least in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is what I'm going to be referencing for the duration of this podcast. So thank you all for joining me today here. I am going to... I'll start with some of the reasons that Peter Parker appeals to a lot of people. Now, the thing about superheroes is we hear a lot about their secret identity, you know, all the games say Spider-Man, all the movies are Spider-Man, the Amazing Spider-Man. But underneath the Spider-Man mask is Peter Parker, who is, in most depictions, a 16-year-old or around that age. In the current MCU run, I believe he started as 16, and now that the movies are, now as the movies have progressed, in his most recent one, he's 18, or at least around that age. And the reason this is important is because it contrasts him in a world of adult heroes like Thor and Tony Stark and Captain America, and all played by major A-list actors, Robert Downey Jr., Chris Evans, that kind of thing. And so it contrasts this 16-year-old boy with these big men with large problems and superpowers. So giving those level of powers to a teenager it's wish fulfillment, but B, it's meant to provide the situation for them to get into trouble with them, where Tony Stark would often solve his own problems using his Iron Man suit. Peter Parker often creates his own problems that he then has to patch together and solve with the Spider-Man suit. That key distinction is what makes the character so appealing to so many people, because Peter Parker, at the end of the day, wants to do right by people. He wants to help. He wants to do good things. The titular line, with great power comes great responsibility, is meant to convey that. It's usually his a familial figure's last words to him and forms the basis of his identity as Spider-Man. And I think the newest Spider-Man, played by Tom Holland, puts it best, that when bad things happen and you have the power to stop the bad things and you don't, the bad things happen because of you. And that's his sort of worldview, that he was given these superpowers by accident, but he still has an obligation to use them for the greater good, which in a teenager's mind usually means swinging around the city and stopping robberies, which are more common in the Marvel's view of New York than I think they actually ought to be. But what often happens in this is that Spider-Man incurs major threats because people see him as a threat, because he is a vigilante. And this is where the dichotomy comes in. And part of one of the cruxes of Peter Parker's character is that he's not always well liked by people, because oftentimes in a lot of the universes, everything's normal and everything's quiet. And then Spider-Man appears, and then the Rhino appears, and Green Goblin appears, and Dr. Octopus appears, and everybody's like, whoa, why does everybody suddenly have superpowers, and why is only one of them not evil? And so they start thinking that Spider-Man's the reason, and that if he went away, so would they. One of the major characters in the franchise is J. Jonah Jameson, who runs the a newspaper, and in the original adaptation, in the newest one, he runs sort of a podcast and then a news show, absolutely bashing Spider-Man. He is a cynic in every sense of the word. He considers Spider-Man to be a dangerous vigilante and that he gives people the wrong idea of what justice is. So he's constantly trying to catch Spider-Man in a gotcha situation where he's like doing something wrong. And so Spider-Man has this constant like fight with being publicly seen as, if not an enemy, at least a potential threat, with his will to like, guys, I'm just here to help people. And this is where the villains usually come in. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the newest movie, No Way Home, because it's important to talk about because it features a lot of the villains from the previous movies. There have been three Spider-Man trilogies, really, in the modern age. The Sam Raimi trilogy, who starred Tobey Maguire. The second one was The Amazing Spider-Man, which was only a duology. I think it was meant to be a trilogy, but the third movie was never released, featuring Andrew Garfield as Spider-Man. And then the newest ones, which are just called Spider-Man, but they have the home in the title. It's Homecoming, Homecoming, Far From Home, and then No Way Home. There was a lot of fun speculation on what kind of home this newest movie would be before they officially revealed the title. And but the villains from Spider-Man's universe all are, for one reason or another, bleeding into this movie. And the reason that it's compelling is because Spider-Man's villains are almost always tragic. And surprisingly, in movies, they've been depicted really well as such. I have to commend Willem Dafoe, as he is quite possibly the greatest Green Goblin we'll ever see on the big screen. And because he portrays the Green Goblin as this, is a split personality, as a stressed businessman, Norman Osborn, driven to extremes in the name of scientific progress, hits himself with trying to be Spider-Man, hits himself with the spider serum, and becomes evil. There's a personality emerges with him that tells him that he can rule the world with his new powers. And that's the contrast to Spider-Man, where Spider-Man wants to help the world with his powers. The Green Goblin wants to rule and terrorize with the powers. And there's even a great monologue in the first Spider-Man movie between from Willem Dafoe to Spider-Man, or as Green Goblin to Spider-Man, where he says, we could keep fighting each other over and over and letting innocent people die, or we could team up and rule the world. And he obviously, Spider-Man says, no, I don't want to do that. But it's a compelling point that's a lot of his villains end up doing that, because they, for one reason or another, usually fall from grace. The best example is Alfred Molina's Doc Ock, Dr. Octopus, from the second movie in the first trilogy. Dr. Otto Octavius is his name, and yes, there's a key motif in the Spider-Man universe that characters have alliterating first and last names, And so, yeah, Peter Parker, Otto Octavius. But Dr. Octavius is a brilliant inventor who is usually at the end of his rope. He's like, his grants are running out, and he hasn't produced anything super meaningful in the time to warrant a refresher. And so he has one last experiment, which is usually involves the arms, or sometimes is the arms. In the movie, he uses the arms to control a fusion reactor that he's made that effectively makes a small sun. The downside of the fusion reactor, though, is it goes into meltdown, and they have to shut it down. And in the process, it electrocutes them and fries a key mechanism of the arms that keep them from, like, basically having their own personality. And for some reason or another, their personality tends to be sort of an evil snake on the shoulder, which convinces the doctor to start committing crimes in order to build the reactor again to perfect it this time. This is the reason all of his villains are tragic, because the reason we find out about Dr. Octavius is because Peter Parker is there to take photography, because he's a science whiz, he's a science kid. And so he's there on a photography mission to document the reveal of this amazing new technology. And because he's also Spider-Man, he watches it all go wrong, changes into the suit, and manages to save most people, except for Doc Ock's wife. And, she might be the only casualty, actually. And so that leads into the tragedy that becomes Doc Ock's past, is that he starts to commit acts he can't be forgiven for. But he's still the same Dr. Octavius that just wanted to help people by creating a clean, sustainable form of energy. So Peter Parker's dilemma is to fight these people and not kill them, because, like, unlike some representations of Batman, Peter Parker does not kill, like, ever. That's his whole thing, is that he refuses to. And so he has to go through beat down after beat down, just trying to keep his villain alive, but also apprehend them and save everyone, every civilian in the process. And watching his struggle of trying to juggle all three of those is usually the crux of the movies and what the current movie tackles the most. Now, I mentioned that there's three of these. And there's actually a fourth one. And if you thought it was impossible to juggle all the first three, Peter finds it incredibly difficult to balance the fourth one. And that's just being Peter Parker. He's a high school student most of the time. And he's a college student, or he has a job. Peter Parker has to live. He has to go do stuff. He has friends. He has family. He has stuff to do. But oftentimes, he can't go be himself because of Spider-Man, because the world needs Spider-Man and he can't just disappear. And oftentimes he does, and then terrible things happen, and then he has to come to terms with the fact that he can't always get what he wants, and he has to step up and be Spider-Man, which is an incredibly mature lesson to be taught at 16 years old, which is, it usually takes them a while for the great power comes great responsibility lesson to kick in. He usually has to go through either a tragedy or a very, very near miss, depending on the depiction, for him to actually get out of his shell and realize, okay, if I'm going to work this out, it's going to be hard, but I have to face it head on. And it depends on the adaptation, but sometimes this does cause problems for him. In some, he doesn't tell anybody, or the people he tells are slain because of it, and he has to deal with the fallout of that. There's Into the Spider-Verse introduced one of those Spider-Men, or Spider-Woman, actually. Spider-Gwen, who is actually one of his love interests, become a Spider-Man in her own comic series. And in that, her Peter Parker becomes her enemy, and that's the tragedy there. So it's Spider-Man is always faced with this choice of either let the bad things happen or let them happen to you and be Spider-Man. And that is at the crux of his identity. And that's a struggle that I think a lot of kids grow up with, you know, wanting to help everybody and be there for everybody, and finding that eventually juggling that comes kind of hard. You kind of have to find a balance there, you know, where you can't always do everything you want. You can't always do everything everyone else wants. And you got to find this happy medium where you're doing both. And that is the theme of most of the trilogies, actually. It's sort of a recurring theme in Peter Parker's life and in a lot of his comics. Now, moving a little bit deeper into some of the more fun appeal of the character, I'll take us out of the darkness there a little bit. Peter Parker is generally pretty fun. He's a fun guy. He's usually pretty energetic, like very, very witty. That's his whole point, is that he has tons of witticisms to spare. He's very quippy during his fights. But he's also, as I mentioned previously, sort of a genius engineer. In the original Spider-Man trilogy with Tobey Maguire, he just shoots his webs out of his wrists. We don't ask questions beyond that. But in the later movies and in the comics, it's depicted that he builds webs and web shooters. The webs are a fluid he constructed that only he knows the actual composition of. And the web shooters are a little mechanism on his hand that lets him do that. All he has is physical strength, supernatural perception, and the ability to stick to walls, really. The web shooters are what let him do stuff, so he literally builds his own arsenal in his apartment out of spare parts. That's usually how it happens. There's a great scene at the beginning of the new trilogy where Tony Stark is talking to Peter Parker, and he looks over and he has an old Macintosh on the computer, and all the wires are sticking out of it and plugged into other circuit boards, and it's a depiction of that Spider-Man, Peter Parker, is an engineer. He literally builds solutions to his own problems, which is part of the reason that he's so liked, is because a lot of people like to see Iron Man, who built the Iron Man suit to help people. They like to see a 16-year-old be able to put together his own gadgets and gizmos to help save the world. So when stories depict this sort of nerdy, awkward 16-year-old kid who's this massive science whiz, obtaining these amazing powers and using them to do good and also sort of embrace his own hobbies and further his own education, it's meant to be an inspiring story that, you know, it Peter Parker is not Spider-Man because of the powers, he's Spider-Man because of who he is. A message that extends into pretty much the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe, and what I mentioned earlier, the enduring legacy of superheroes. The reason that the movie was titled Avengers Endgame is because it was the end cap to basically an era of the films. A bunch of films, as I mentioned last time, intertwine with each other in interesting ways. And they can feed off of each other and inform each other. Like, Spider-Man does not appear in his own movie first. We actually see him talking with Tony Stark in a Captain America movie. And that's meant to be his introduction as a character. So if you didn't watch that movie, you might be surprised when Spider-Man comes out in a movie, when you're like, oh, cool, there's a new Spider-Man. But in a more abstract sense, the themes of each movie can kind of feed off of each other. One thing is, I will just mention right off the cuff, watching Iron Man get into one of his suits is really cool. It is just so cool. It looks awesome every time. It, like, even in the first movie, one of the characters says, that is the coolest thing I have ever seen. And he is right. Watching all the parts interlock, all the gears clink, and all the screws get tightened, and watching all the pieces move together, it is so cool. Watching his HUD come up and him talking to Jarvis, it is just so cool. But one of the reasons it is so cool, and one of the major themes of Iron Man movies, is that only Tony Stark could do this, but he's still just an engineer. All of his gadgets and gizmos, to some degree, make sense, even if you have to accept the comic book part of his arc reactor being the thing that powers them. That's the thing technology we don't even have on a large scale yet. But if you accept that, then everything else he does is his own work. Building the Iron Man suit is a response to himself being in danger. And then we watch through his movies as the Iron Man suit becomes a response to other people being in danger. So much so that they literally start to pilot themselves. He makes some that can that can function completely without him in them. And that's actually one of the major plot points of Iron Man 3. And then he eventually tries to make one that can protect the whole world, and that leads to the main antagonist of the second Avengers movie. He tries to protect the whole world and instead creates a robot who decides that the biggest threat to the world is the people on it. So they have to put a stop to that. And we see this time and time again where these heroes try to have everything. They try to help everybody or solve every problem and get what they want and live a normal life. But their professional duties, in this case, you know, saving the world and helping people from supernatural and extraterrestrial threats, always take precedent over that. One of the major themes of the Thor franchise is that at the beginning of his first movie, he's kind of a petulant child who is in the shadow of his father's war and wants to live up to his father's glory by starting another war. And Odin realizes he's failed when Thor says that, because he's like, oh, I've been trying to tell you not to do that my entire life, and apparently I was wrong. So he banishes him to Earth and says, when you're worthy, you can come back. And he has to decide what that means, and eventually it means helping the people of Earth. And he spends the rest of his movies just trying to help people and try to, you know, salvage his life, because he had, being an Asgardian prince kind of has complications there that are explored in the other movies. So you get this sort of continuation of themes from Peter Parker wanting to do good, Iron Man protecting himself, then wanting to do good, Thor just being angry and upset and then wanting to do good, and they all connect together, which is what makes the Avengers so compelling. Watching them all come together means that they have to fight something really strong, because on their own, they are each really strong. And so when they all have to come together as a team, that means that there's a big problem. And that's just, again, fun to watch. It is fun to watch the Avengers do their thing. Like Captain America says in the first Avengers, Hulk, smash. That's all you gotta say, man. It's just fun to watch. But while I'm talking about Captain America, I'll bring it full circle with saying that Captain America is a very literal distillation of these ideals. So, as dumb as the name is, Captain America, he's an older character, we give him credit for that. In his modern adaptation, his name is Steve Rogers, a emaciated, skinny, ill man who really wants to fight the Nazis, but not specifically not to kill Nazis, because he doesn't like bullies. A doctor asks him, why do you want to fight so bad? And he says, because I don't like bullies. And that's his whole thing. He gets bullied a lot for being skinny and emaciated. And then when he gets the super soldier serum, it's described as just amplifying him. Instead of, you know, giving him super strong muscles or whatever, it amplifies his qualities. So when he becomes a super soldier, he only wants to do right, and now he can, and that's what he does. And that's his whole thing, is just trying to do right by the world and people and keep major dictators from coming into power. His whole thing is this: he starts fighting the Nazis, and he continues dealing with the idea of control and surveillance and stuff like that. And he wants to believe in the people, in the best in people, and help them out. And he fights for those ideals, which is why we like him. When he buckles up and says, I can do this all day, that's his way of saying, you can continue to hit me. Even if I can't hit you, you can continue to hit me. Just don't hit anything else. And that's his whole thing. He doesn't have a gun. He doesn't have a spear. He has a shield, an unbreakable shield. And that's his whole deal. So when you get to see all these characters interact, all of their ideals combine, and it contrast and intermingle together because for varying reasons, they all want to do the right thing. And how they go about it and how those ways can combine together are the most interesting parts. Like a very crude example being when Thor hits Captain America's shield with his hammer, it sends out a sonic boom shockwave that destroys a lot of stuff within about 5 feet around him. And that's cool to see because later in the movies we get to see them use that creatively and it's fun to watch. So we get to watch these characters go through these deep emotional journeys, come to terms with their responsibilities and their powers and their abilities, and then we get to watch them have fun with them. And that's some of the enduring legacy of the superhero movies, is that they carry these deep-seated themes of growing up, of responsibility, of protection, of letting things go, of moving on. But also you get to watch the Hulk smash stuff. And later you get to watch Bruce Banner and the Hulk have an identity crisis. It's incredible. It's really incredible. No pun intended. I wanted to kind of come on today to talk a little bit about the enduring legacy of superhero movies now that the third of the newest Spider-Man trilogy is out in theaters and will probably be exiting soon here. I'll be back again to talk about more superheroes and maybe something else in a later podcast. So have a great day. All right, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening to Full Circle Analog, where we connect with the Inland Empire's musical roots. If you really enjoyed this podcast and like to find out when our next episodes go live, we upload every Wednesday. And to get direct links to those episodes, go ahead and follow us at Full Circle Analog on Facebook. You can find us at fb.me/FCAnalog to get there quickly. Or you can find us at odnws.com/podcast. It's our official website, and that page has a link to our podcast on basically any platform you can find it on, as well as players for our most popular platforms. Thanks for listening. Check us out next week on Full Circle Analog.